Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I mean, that's the reason I had to do Dancing on Ice, right? No one does that because they love the idea. People do that because they have the wolf at the door. Right. You know, Celebrity Coach Trip wasn't a creative decision. I had a tax bill. The worst thing people could do is go, oh, you're that TV presenter.
Matt Richardson.
And I'd always go, I'm a stand-up comedian, actually. Anywhere okay. In my family, I was the first one to go to university. Like, my dad left school at 15, no qualification. It was a big deal. And I ended up dropping out of university after a year and a half to do comedy. I didn't tell my dad for 6 months. And he went ballistic. He was apoplectic. TV's done.
Yeah.
TV is dead. You know, if ITV1 had a show with 1 million viewers, that would be their biggest disaster. Yet they are the podcast superstars. I had a DVD deal when I was, like, new. I did the Extra Factor. I did the X Factor spin-off show. And, like, me going, taking a deviation 11 years ago was seen as, like, career suicide. I probably made $250,000. The hotels get nicer and the flights get... You turn left rather than right when you go in anywhere. But it's just travelling. If you're not good by yourself, it's not a great job. I've had lots of sex. I've done plenty of drugs. I would pick having a perfect gig over anything else in the world. You know when people talk about the X Factor?
Yeah.
There's only two I've ever met. Michael Bublé, Harry Styles, like special people.
Wow.
Like genuinely like blew me away. I do the Red Bull Soapbox Race on Dave. And Red Bull Soapbox Race champions.
The Red Bull story is bonkers, fizzy can of stuff that doesn't taste amazing.
I think officially it does taste amazing,
yeah, okay,
actually.
So, Matt, I've just finished recording your podcast, I Am Prime Minister.
Yeah, thank you for coming on.
And now we've spun the mics round and you're coming on my podcast, Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. What's your job?
I'm a stand-up comedian. And I'd say I'm quite adamant about saying I'm that because that was my dream. I always wanted to be a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
But I, throughout my 15 years of doing it, like I've spent a lot of time doing other things. So I've done TV presenting, I've done radio, podcasts, yeah, and everything else. And like, you know, quite often doing live comedy is probably like, you know, a tiny bit of my income, but I always see myself as a comic.
That's your kind of label of it.
Yeah, that's how I see myself, even though other people don't. And like the worst thing you could say to me in the early days of when I was doing TV, a lot of TV presenting, the worst thing people could do is go, oh, you're that TV presenter. And I'd always go, I'm a stand-up comedian, actually. Like, I had a real thing about wanting to be a comic.
Yeah. That's so, because I would almost think of you as kind of like a broadcaster, right? But that's the kind
of... Yeah, but like now that doesn't bother me. Like, yeah. I'm fine, because I've done so much radio and TV and everything else. But like, stand-up takes up most of my time as well. So stand-up is that weird thing where like I did 300 live shows last year in the comedy clubs. Yeah,
wow.
I mean, it's a
so
lot.
That's gig every night, right?
Or six, yeah, hours, well,
seven.
Or like
you're doubling up sometimes.
Sometimes like three or four in a night, so it's you're okay. But I still don't see my girlfriend that much. But yeah, it's like it takes up most of your time, but it's probably the worst paid bit of it.
Yeah.
So then a broadcasting job comes up and you go, yeah, I'll do that because that's easy money.
That's easy
compared
money
to driving to flipping, you know, Cumbria to go make £200.
And well, you started like really early, right?
Yeah, I was 18. So I started doing it at 18. I started gigging and then I was doing it full time by 20. I was doing it professionally, like a living from it. I was kind of doing that because I didn't. So my start was I went to university, hated it, And I shouldn't have gone, really. I should have gone and done something else. But I wasn't ready for university. And there was a comedy night. And it'd been my dream job since I was 15 to be a comedian. So I went and did the comedy night. And I ended up dropping out of university after a year and a half to do comedy.
Because you were doing publishing at uni, right?
I was doing publishing, yeah.
What led to that choice?
So it's not the normal, like, I love this and that. I knew I didn't really want to go to university, but I was doing A-levels and that's what everyone did. So I looked at a course. I was going to do government at LSE.
Oh, right.
That was my dream course. Yeah. But one of my teachers wouldn't predict me the right grade, so I couldn't apply. So then I was like, well, I wanted to do government. That was my dream course to go and do. So I'm just going to go and apply to do something media-y, I guess, at Oxford Brookes. So I didn't have to go away. So I could live at home and do uni. That's why I did it.
And that reminds me of the idea that I was one of the ideas that I didn't mention. Obviously, on your podcast, you ask people what they do as prime minister.
I love it. Bonus episode.
Bonus episode for it, right? But it's bonkers that we make people apply to university on the basis of predicted grades. Where else do you do that in life?
It's like, insanity.
Like, I would do it so you get your results, but you don't start your first year of university until January. So, because actually the first year of university is a bit of a piss take anyway.
Absolutely.
Like, and so it's just, so you do two terms then, and then you go into your second and third year, rather than this all this predicted grades bullshit, because it does massively, like, I think it really, it just favours advantage kids and stuff.
Absolutely.
Like,
and also, the ironic thing is, like, I needed an A in history, and I got an A at my AS level, and the teacher and I didn't really get on, so he predicted me a B, and I got an A in the end.
Yeah. Right.
So, like, I couldn't go and do the course that I had the grades to do in the end, but I couldn't apply for it.
Yeah.
Which was really frustrating, because being a SPAD, like, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go and work for an MP or a quango and go into that world.
Yeah.
Like, that was my dream job, really, when I was a teenager, because I did politics at A level and loved it.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing publishing media at Oxford Brookes University because I was sort of a bit stuck and in this weird purgatory of it all. And I really enjoyed it. Like, it was quite media-y. I think a job in publishing would have been a really interesting and fun thing to go and do. But I didn't know what I wanted. I had no idea. I just wanted to be a comedian and didn't know how to do that when I was 17 either.
But when you dropped out, your dad made you, like, properly treat it as a job.
Yeah, right? Well, so I dropped out. And I didn't tell my dad for 6 months. So, because I was living at home.
Yeah.
So I was living at home, doing university, and I was doing university. And then I started doing stand-up at 18, the first year of university. And there's a load of competitions when you start. And there's a big one called So You Think You're Funny.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the big, well-respected one. And I got to the final of it. Like, my final, it was me, a guy called Liam Williams, who's very successful as a sitcom on the BBC, Rob Beckett, Ramesh Ranganathan. Like, it's like the who's who of now who's done all right. Did that, was gigging loads. And I was missing all these lectures all the time.
Yeah.
And my tutor pulled me aside and went, "What's going on?" My attendance was like 4% or something. It was really bad.
Yeah.
And I told her that I was doing stand-up, it was going really well. And she said, "Go and do that." She goes, "This is always waiting for you. Go and do that and use the momentum." And I told my mum and she agreed. And then we both pretended to my dad that I was still going to university. So I would get up on the days I was meant to be in lectures, drive away from the house as if I was going to university, wait for him to leave, and then I'd come back.
Wow.
And it took 6 months for me to tell him the truth that I dropped out, and he went ballistic. He was apoplectic. Because I was the first one in the family to ever go.
Yeah.
Anywhere in my family, I was the first one to go to university. Like, my dad left school at 15, no qualifications. My mum, you know, went and did a secretary course. Like, it was a big deal. And he was not happy until I did a show in my hometown. In the local arts centre, I kind of did my own show and it went really well. And he went, "Okay, you can do this.
Okay.
But you treat it like a day job. So you go out, you gig in the nights," and he wanted me gigging minimum 5 nights a week.
Yeah.
And he goes, "But you get 8 hours sleep." And he worked from home quite a lot. And he went, "I'll give you 8 hours and then you're up and you're doing emails or you're writing."
Yeah.
So he made me treat it like a job and gave me a really good work ethic, which even now I've still, like, I gig loads, I do everything. Like, I'm a workaholic and I love it. But when we were starting out, like, I was known as, like, the hard-gigging, hard-working comedian because I had to.
So how do you go about doing that writing comic then? Like, how do you sort of, do you just sit there with a blank piece of paper and think, "That was something funny I saw yesterday, what can I spin off that?"
Yes, but I'm terrible at it. I really hate the writing. I don't know if you can swear on your podcast
or not.
Yeah,
yeah, it's fine.
hate writing. It's the bit about, like, I would rather sit and do my mileage than write comedy. I find it so difficult. Because you must know this, you know, I'm sure you've written speeches and anything like that. When you have a really set thing, so if someone goes to you, write 1,000 words on this really specific subject, at least you've got a place to start. But stand-up, when you're writing a new show, you just go, well, I just need an hour of stuff, of anything. It's so difficult. Once I've got a little bit, then I'm quite good at writing on stage. So, like, you know, going on stage and, like, riffing. I hate comedians talking like this. Like, I just riff. I just, you know, like, just in the moment. But you can, when the gig's going well and the audience is on side, like, you will come up with, like, extra little bits.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of that on stage. But I hate writing. It's so hard. It's like a job.
Yeah.
And I've got plenty of comic friends. Like, Milton Jones, for example, sits 9 till 1 every day and writes 5 days a week.
Okay.
And I find that really hard to do. I try and do a couple of days a week where I sit for, like, an hour or two with ideas that, like, my phone is full of, like, random little bits. Like, hang on, chuck me my phone, James. We'll go through it.
Oh, this will be good. We'll get some live.
We'll go through, like... So this is the kind of stuff that happens is you're wandering around... And you go, oh, God, I've, you know, you see something, you go, oh, that's quite funny. So you write it down and then you put it in your phone and you look back on it in the cold light of day like now and you go, what was I thinking?
Yeah, yeah. So how descriptive do you get when you write? Because you think, oh, I'll just write 2 words and that'll trigger the memory.
So this is last night at 1:41 a.m. So I've woken up in the middle of the night and written this down in my phone. And this is all it says, like 30s, dull, 20s, so much going on, plans, 30s, going to people's houses. When I was in my 20s, I never knew where my friends lived, and now I know how nice my friend's furniture is. Like, that's it. That's all I've written down there. But I've woken up in the middle of the night and gone, well, that needs saving forever.
Can't forget that.
And then what I'll do now is go and write that down and go, okay, that is like sort of... A lot of my stuff at the moment is like the difference between your 20s and your 30s. You know, like all my friends are having kids and getting married. I've got a lot of new material coming around that. So I'll sit with that. I'll go on to a gig. Tomorrow night I'm doing a new material gig where I'll go, you know what it's like? And you'll sort of just talk about it and see if you can get any laughs. And then that might turn into something.
Yeah.
But even now I've got routines that I do that I've got a routine in my current set that I've been doing for like 5 years that is about my girlfriend being so drunk I have to take out her for her. And that started out as one joke. And now the long version of that is 13 minutes.
Wow.
So it sort of slowly grows and then a bit stops working. So you cut it again. You're sort of constantly pruning and adding.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a set thing, at least not for me. Like, I don't finish a routine and go, that's done. Like, it's always evolving.
But do you have a set, like a set list of where you think, okay, well, I'm going to do these different bits?
Yes, totally. Yeah. But it's more like, oh, I'll do the tampon bit or I'll do the bit about my friend's kid's birthday party. But that bit will chop and change and like slightly evolve over time.
Yeah.
It's never like a set thing. Like, because it's certain rooms you'll do it. Like, you'll do it a few times. There'll be one bit of it that doesn't get a laugh. And if it stopped getting a laugh, you go, well, that's got to go.
Yeah.
That's the good thing about comedy is there is a way, it's binary. Does that get a laugh or not?
Yeah.
Like, it's very easy to work out what you're going to use. It's not like there's an objective thing. If in a room it doesn't get a laugh consistently, it's gone.
It's gone.
Yeah.
And how long do you try that then? How long is consistent? Like 300 gigs last year, say.
So there's bits that are like in my... You have your bankers, your A-list.
Yeah,
like, I've got an A-list, a B-list and a C-list.
Okay.
So when I'm doing 20 minutes, depending on the club, but if you're doing like the weekendy clubs, you've got your A, like that's your bankable, works everywhere. Stag do's, hen do's, 300 drunk people, or an art centre, it's going to get the same reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have your B, which is if you're doing a bit of a longer set and it fits in and it's a bit gentler. And then your C, which if you're doing a tour show. So there's this weird thing as well, that this is really nerdy comedy stuff. By all means, tell me if it's
great.
Boring. There's stuff you can do in a tour show that's quite, not personal, but the audience needs to be more into you.
Yes,
that doesn't work when you go into a club and they don't care who you are. So I've got routines about like the TV shows I've been on and I've done and that funny stories about that. But when you're doing 20 minutes in Birmingham on a Saturday night, they're like, no one cares about Celebrity Coach Trip.
Yeah.
No one gives a shit that you've met Leslie Joseph. Whereas in a longer show where they know you a bit more and your career and stuff. And
they've bought a ticket for
they've
you.
They've come to you, then they're a bit more open to those stories.
Right. Okay,
rather than just jokes about wanking. Which I have plenty of. Like, yeah, I'm a big wank joke guy.
And what, how has kind of like social media changed the game, because when you started, basically didn't exist really.
Twitter was just blowing up in 2009 when I started.
Yeah.
So that was at, like, the genesis of Twitter. And what's been really interesting with social media, and I guess you found this in, you know, everything you do with podcasts and stuff, it's a full-time job now.
Yeah.
Alongside, if you want people put stand-up out, whereas when I started, you were encouraged to never share your stuff.
Mm.
Online, especially because you weren't getting paid. Like Live at the Apollo and things like that paid you loads of money because that material was burnt then.
Yeah.
Couldn't use it anymore. Whereas now, you just churn it out constantly.
Just constantly.
Yeah, yeah. So that's made it much harder. But when I started, social media was... What's been interesting is I've been around long enough that, like, I remember when you go on a TV show, like, even something like the 50 greatest body shockers, like a show about terrible tattoos on E4 where you're just a talking head, you'd go on there and you'd pick up 3,000 or 4,000 Twitter followers just because people were interacting with Twitter in that way. And then that stopped happening on Twitter, so you move to Instagram. And then Instagram's not getting the same thing. So I've seen that every few years there's that next platform
thing.
And it's TikTok at the moment, obviously. I'm sure you're on there
with
podcast stuff. It'll be something else. TikTok will be done. And I always find by the time I get to grips with one, it's way too late.
And it gets harder as you get older, right? Like...
Yeah, and also, you know, I think I had a conversation with... So there's a social media guy who works for the podcast company that I do my podcast with. And we put up loads of stuff from the podcast. And he posts on my profiles. And he said to me recently, he's like, look, you know, this podcast stuff's doing okay, but it'll have more impact if you share more of yourself.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't want to share any of myself. I just want to share my stand-up and my podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Why do I have to put up, like, personal stuff in between just so people buy into me more?
I would love
to have done all of this pre all of that, this stuff.
So do you think it's made it better or worse then? It made comedy better or worse?
It's really tricky because I think it's made it more democratic because they're in...
Yeah.
I have friends who couldn't get on television, who are brilliant, and now have a following because they shared their stuff online.
Yeah.
Which is excellent. It's gotten rid of a lot of the gatekeeping. However...
And they can be like, I am funny because I've got 100,000 followers or whatever. Like,
yeah, and or they can start selling those people tour tickets and they've built their own audience. Yeah. And I think that's really great. But I didn't get into comedy to edit videos.
Yeah,
and I'm finding that really hard, you know. And it's not like it's a hard job, but it's just not what I'm good at or what I wanted.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it was great in the 90s where people just rang up the clubs. You'd do the clubs, do Edinburgh, do well in Edinburgh, you'd do a tour.
Yeah.
And it was sort of word of mouth. You go on telly twice and you'd be fine for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
Whereas you know,
now.
No.
Do you think there's more comedians now then?
Maybe. I think, but people were moaning about that 15 years ago when I started.
Yeah.
You know, like when there was like those competitions. So there was one called the Laughing Horse. They all had, weirdly, the Amuse Moose, the Laughing Horse, they all had animal names. And it was a new act competition and 1,000 people would enter every year. But comedy's a pyramid, right? So the open mic scene, there is hundreds and hundreds of people doing like the open mic gigs in London, 15 acts on a night, 5 people in the audience, grim. There's hundreds of those. Of that lot, maybe 10% get to the next level where they're doing like pay gigs for £20-30. And of that lot, 10% again, like 10% of that get to the next level where they're doing £100 gigs. And of that 10%, you get to the £200-250 gigs where you're doing the proper weekend clubs.
Yeah.
And of that level, only 10% of those ever tour. And of that level, only 10% again. So you're looking at like 0.1% of people who start end up where Mickey Flanagan is.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of people at the bottom of the pyramid, but it does thin out as you go up.
But presumably it's also been quicker to climb the pyramid as well now.
Yeah, I think so. And also, you know, there's a group of like older school sort of circuit comedians who are all about paying your dues.
Yeah.
Like you did the, you know, like Mickey Flanagan or is a perfect example, or Sean Locke. You do the circuit for 10 years, then you get on a bit of telly, then you can go and do that. Whereas some people are doing it super quick.
Yeah.
And they're fine because they're very talented. But a lot of people are doing it quick and getting on telly within a couple of years and then don't have the experience to back it up.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I do think it's a job where the longer you do it for, the better you get, obviously, like anything. But you have, like, I have probably 2 hours of material, 3 hours of material in my tank that I can, if all of a sudden I blew up tomorrow and I was playing 3,000-seat theatres, I could put together a pretty solid hour and a half.
Yeah.
That I think if you're new and that happens, and then you do that tour, you don't, and everyone comes and goes, well, that was shit, so I'm not going to go again.
Yeah.
That's the thing is, if you have a terrible live gig that's your solo show, those people are never coming back to see you again.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I've died on my ass at a tour show at, like, some art centre in, like, Yeah, Staffordshire. Market Drayton. We'll use that as an example because that's true. The first time I went on tour, I did Market Drayton on tour. Absolutely died on my hole to like 150 people in this theatre. Went back next time on tour, there were 50 people.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You can see when you do well or not well. So I think you've got to be ready.
And so how before social media did you sell tickets for Market Drayton then?
They had a mailing list and like, you know, people that were members of the theatre.
You relied on them.
Yeah, yeah. And like adverts in the local paper.
Yeah.
So it was a big thing. You'd go on the local BBC station and, you know, go on BBC Stafford and talk about your tour date and that would sell your tickets.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas that doesn't happen anymore. You know, every tour I do, they go, oh, we're going to do a round of BBC local interviews. And I go, well, there's no point.
Yeah.
We're not going to sell a single... Everyone who listens to it's 800.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you go on these BBC stations and, like, I really think there is a place for local BBC. I just think they're really... As someone that's done national radio and local radio, the BBC have... absolutely fumbled the ball on local radio.
Yeah, yeah,
they could have totally regenerated it when all the things like Capital and Heart went national. And you go on there now and they're like, so first off, we are talking to Matt Richardson, the comedian. And then after that, we have a local councillor telling you about the new bins. And you just go, no one's coming to my show after the bin chat. What's the point?
I do think the podcast revolution is quite interesting for some of that stuff, because I think we could end up with some really interesting... Because filling radio is hard, right? You know this. You hosted.
Oh, Virgin, my God, like, awful.
Doing 24 hours, 7 days a week is bloody hard. GB News are finding this as well, right? Whereas actually, you know, most local news could probably be covered off in a really good hour and a half podcast at a weekend that could be put together by
absolutely.
People.
Right? You know, it's funny. I had a conversation. So I was on a radio station in Oxfordshire last year for 8 months. I did a breakfast show. And the person I did it with was the newsreader. We co-hosted the breakfast show. And I texted her last week going, is there scope? Because she's still doing the Oxfordshire news for what's become Greatest Hits. And I went, surely you could just have like a local podcast once a week that's just about Oxfordshire with interesting people on that sort of eats the BBC's lunch at BBC Oxford. That would be easy to do. And people would love it, right? Because they don't miss that one really good segment because it's there forever and it's in an hour-long podcast.
Yeah.
I think podcasting is a really, once again, it's a leveller.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's
plenty
of comics who've got their own podcast who, you know, and also the good thing about podcasts is radio and TV are quite passive mediums. So, like, even when I was on the radio, you know, at Virgin, I had quite a lot of listeners. I never sold any tickets to them because they're listening to you in the background. It's not their main priority. Podcast is such an engaging medium. You can have 20,000 listeners and make a living off them because they are in.
They're bought in.
You know, I've got friends who've got podcasts with maybe 800-900 Patreons, which sounds like nothing, but they're all paying £2-3 a month. That's a living.
Yeah, yeah.
Off a tiny audience, these kind of like micro audiences that are super engaged with you. That is the way to do it now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really interesting podcasting because, you know, what you deem as, there's some big podcasts. So even like the news agents, right? The news agents probably has 1 million listeners.
Yeah.
1 million in TV is terrible numbers, or it was 10 years ago. You know, I did shows that, you know, if ITV1 had a show with 1 million viewers, that would be their biggest disaster. Yet they are the podcast superstars because their audience are so engaged.
Yeah, yeah, it's true, actually.
It's really fascinating how it's sort of, it's boiled it down to your hardcore fans.
And what do you think the future's going to look like in terms of this as well? Where do you think this plays out in 5, 10 years? I mean, TV's struggling big time.
TV's done.
Yeah.
TV is dead. We're done. Like, TV, like, I would now say, like, I go into meetings, and bear in mind that for the last 10 years at least, 11 years, I've been pitching TV ideas, I've been hosting TV shows, and you just slowly notice that, you know, every agent I've ever been with, and I've been with a lot of agents, I'm a bit of a nightmare for that, it's always about, like, right, we need to get you in front of this commissioner and that commissioner and this person to try and get you on a TV show. That isn't even the conversation anymore.
Yeah.
It's all about live. Live comedy, everyone thought TV would kill live comedy years ago. Everyone thought that putting comedy on TikTok would kill live comedy. I would say live comedy is the healthiest it's ever been. I think live comedy is in a really interesting place, and it's diversified in a way that you used to go and do, you know, you used to go and spend 3 days in Birmingham doing the Glee Club at the weekend. You know, 3 shows over 3 days, or maybe 2 shows on a Saturday night, and those were the big clubs. Now, that's post-pandemic, it's town halls, village halls, all run these amazing smaller gigs where people go to their local thing. Like, I've got a gig in an art centre in Didcot where I grew up. We sell 250 tickets every month and we get amazing acts on, and it's like a community comedy club.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's become like a much more independent grassroots thing out in the sticks, and I love that. But TV's gone. Like, I don't have meetings anymore going, what TV shows are we trying to get on? It's yeah. about podcasting, it's about TikTok, it's about live, it's all those things rather than TV. It used to be, the dream was, you go on Mock the Week, Live at the Apollo, Have I Got News for You, and then you'd go and sell out the Hammersmith Apollo on your own back.
Yeah, yeah.
And that just isn't the way anymore.
But it's so funny because it's like so many careers, isn't it? The career ladder, the career path is just gone, right? And it's all a squiggly mess, basically.
Yeah, totally. But it used to, so the big thing with comedy was, and I think a lot of big agencies that looked after big acts were slow to catch up. You'd work and work, get good on the circuit, get an agent, which you don't need anymore.
Yeah.
Loads of big people without agents now, whereas it used to be you'd have to be with one of the big three agencies if you wanted to be massive.
And who were they? There was Off the Curb.
Off the Curb, Avalon.
Yeah.
And Hannah Chambers. They were like the big three that were like the kingmakers. And then I'd say over the last 5 or 6 years, and there was a couple of others that were sort of like United. And like, I mean, I've been with everyone, like, so I'm not a king. So, but now there's loads more sort of smaller boutique agents. And there are people that these agents try and get and they go, why? What are you going to offer me that I can no longer do for myself?
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a
That's
podcast.
A power shift, right?
Well, look at, there's a podcast called Have a Word.
Yeah.
It's a massive comedy podcast. Adam Rowe, Dan Nightingale, two comedians, started it themselves, built this thing. They have tens of thousands of patrons. They've just done the Echo Arena in Liverpool, wow, doing a podcast record. And they have no big management behind them, no big companies. They're doing it all themselves.
Yeah.
And you just think, well, why give someone 15%?
Yeah,
so that's really changed. But yeah, it's just, you know, now look at someone like Jonathan Pye, right?
Mm.
Jonathan Pye, who was uploading silly videos to Facebook and Twitter, has just done two nights at the Hammersmith Apollo. 7,000 tickets.
Wow.
You know, he's on a huge That's tour nuts. Playing 2,000-seat theatres. He has never been near a TV show like Mock the Week or Live at the Apollo. Whereas when I started, the dream was you do that, you do your hour in Edinburgh, and then your agent tries to get you on Mock the Week and Live at the Apollo. And yeah, that was the ladder. And everyone did the same ladder, and it just isn't the way anymore.
And that's changed in 10 years as well, right? Like, it's really...
Well, I remember...
And then it was the DVD deal, right?
That oh, my God, then you wanted a DVD deal, and then you were laughing, right?
Yeah.
It was such a big thing that, like, I was with an agency. We all got DVD. I had a DVD deal when I was, like, new. But I wasn't on a deal where you were guaranteed one. They just gave you some money every year to keep you sweet because they were making so much cash out of DVDs. Like, they were giving me 10 grand a year just to, like, keep you in line for a DVD deal. It was insanity.
Yeah.
Like, it was madness. And then now, obviously, like, that died, which is a shame because I think comedians were making millions off of those DVDs. But now, even when I started 10, 11 years ago, I did the Extra Factor. I did the X Factor spin-off show.
Yeah.
And even at that point, I had comedians I knew who would go, why are you doing that? Like, you need that will mean you're never going to do Mock the Week and Live at the Apollo because you're going to be a presenter. And like, me going taking a deviation 11 years ago was seen as like career suicide. Whereas now, like, you don't need any of that stuff. Well, Mock the Week's gone.
Well, yeah, true, right? And like, on the sort of salary transparency stuff and whatever, like, what's been your sort of best year and what's been your kind of worst year? Give us a sort of like range of this.
This is so my best year. Was probably, are HMRC listening?
No.
Okay, fine. Then my best year, my best, like, well, when you're starting, like, I've like made like 10 grand in a year, like when I was new and stuff. But because I was doing TV within like 4 years, so I sort of went, I was making like decent money quite quickly.
Yeah.
And I went pro. So I was making like, within 2 years, I was making sort of 20, 25 grand a year.
Okay.
And then my best year ever, I probably made $250,000.
Pretty decent, right?
Yeah. And then I average out at just like low six figures.
Yeah.
Which is amazing because I talk about my penis for a living and I interview people about being prime minister. You know, I'm not working hard for that money. But then some years, like the pandemic was horrific.
Yeah.
The pandemic, like, I made no money. Like my girlfriend, My girlfriend was supporting us basically. And then... I mean, that's the reason I had to do Dancing on Ice, right? No one does that because they love the idea. People do that because they have the wolf at the door. Right. You know, Celebrity Coach Trip wasn't a creative decision. I had a tax bill. So I've had like some...
And is there... there's a hierarchy within the comedian industry then of those type of shows, like... I mean,
yeah,
obviously,
man,
like, strictly...
Like, reality shows, but it's interesting. So I did Dancing on Ice 3 years ago, and there's been a comedian on every... I was the first stand-up doing it. The first like working stand-up to do it. And there's been a comedian on every year now. It basically takes one and everyone goes, oh, he didn't implode.
Yeah.
Therefore, we can all do it. It's the same as I'm a Celeb, right? Everyone used to turn their nose up. I got offered I'm a Celeb in like 2014, 2015. Didn't do it. Joel Dommett did it 2015.
Yeah.
And then he became a millionaire and comedians went, oh, it looks like quite a good idea, actually. That's what you need. You need like an innovator to go and do it first. And then you go, he did all right. So maybe I'll go, I want
Sean
a Lamborghini.
Walsh has kind of built back a bit from doing
Mate,
it.
Mate, Sean has done really well off the back of it, which he deserves because he's fantastic.
Yeah.
He's one of the best comedians in the country. But yeah, like I think comedians were very, there are certain comedians who are very snobby. Like I said, when I was doing things like The Extra Factor and all that, like people really turned their nose up at it.
And what traits do you think, you asked me the kind of common traits between prime ministers and politicians, what common traits are there between comedians and successful comedians?
Successful comedians?
Yeah.
Drive.
Yeah.
Like, I think you have to be abnormally driven to do it. Like, it's not a fun job.
Yeah.
In the sense that I think it is a fun job, but I don't mind the boring bits. Like... there's a comic called Joe Wells who once talked about the fact that only 1% of doing comedy is doing a gig. That's the smallest part of the job because you spend like, you know, for example, so last week I was in the car. I went to Cardiff Thursday night to do 25 minutes, which that was 2 hours each way in the car.
And are you driving that?
Yeah, I drive.
That's knackering as well.
Right? I do 1,000 miles a week.
Flipping out.
Yeah, I do about 30,000 miles a year. Ish, what like once you sort of like average out, like I do about 30,000 miles a year. And then I drove to Brighton, and then I went to Brighton the next night, travelled 4 hours on the train to Brighton through London, did a gig, stayed over, hung out all day on the Saturday to do a gig the next night, came home another 4 hours home. Like, whereas only out of that, that's an hour of 3 days I was on stage.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of travel, which doesn't appeal to people.
Well, it's fine when you're young, single and whatever, right?
But, yeah, but also like...
Well, it's easier.
It's much easier, but also, luckily my girlfriend is like travels loads for work as well, so we're just both kind of used to it. Like, yeah. She's in fashion and is all over the place. Okay. But it's one of those things where if that bothers you, it's not the job for you. Loads of people are brilliant comedians, but the reality of it is just not for them, which is fair enough. I don't think it's for a lot of people. A lot of admin, like emailing and writing and all that kind of stuff, or just doing your mileage, doing your taxes. So a lot of it's quite dull. Being in hotels by yourself, which is great. I remember the first time I got booked a hotel for a gig, I was like, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened. Whereas now all I want in my life is to be at home as many nights of the week as possible.
Yeah, totally.
And that's the dream, you know. So all those things, I think, it's especially if you're... Look, if you're Ramesh and you're doing these big tours, it's the same problems, just at a different level.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like he's one of my best mates, Rom. I did some support for him a couple of months ago. And, you know, all he wants, like, he's doing two nights this week in Oxford, so I'm going to see him. And I was like, oh, you're around, so you're doing two nights. He's like, no, I'm going home both nights, because I want to be at home. So he's going to commute two nights to the... Because he just wants to be at home. Yeah, the hotels get nicer and the flights get... You turn left rather than right when you go in anywhere. But it's just travelling.
Yeah,
travelling and being by yourself. If you're not good by yourself, it's not a great job.
And also, there must be some drive there in him still doing Oxford. What's the biggest venue in Oxford?
2,000-seater.
Oh, okay, all right, fine.
Yeah, yeah, but he's doing all right off that. But
still
like,
pays the gas bill.
But also, you know, touring, he does hundreds of gigs and like does like work in progress gigs because he loves it.
Yeah.
Also, I think it is addictive.
Yes.
Like there is like a chasing of something. Like doing a gig and it going as well as, like, having an amazing gig, like absolutely smashing a gig, is probably the best feeling on the planet for me.
Yeah.
I would pick that over, look, I've done, you know, I've had lots of sex, I've done plenty of drugs. I would pick having a perfect gig over anything else in the world. If you could give me a perfect gig for zero money, or I'd die on my ass for £1 million, I'd die on my ass for £1 million, that was a stupid example.
Where's the level?
It's just... It's so addictive and you just chase it.
Yeah.
And you're so self-critical, like, you know, and as you get better, you want more. Like, I'm sure you found this in your career. You go, okay, well, I had a great gig and I'm doing this club and I want to do that. There is a ladder within live comedy that you can climb as well, and you always want to move up. Like, the last couple of years, I've sort of been treading water at the same level, and now I'm a bit bored of that, so I want the next thing again.
And what is the next thing now?
So when I tour, I do like 100, 150 seaters. I want to go and play like the 500, 600, 700 seaters.
Yeah, okay.
That'd be, so that's probably two levels away. Really, I'd love to go and play like the 2,000 seaters. That'd be incredible. But very few people get there.
Do you
there.
Think you'd lose something on that though? Because it's quite interesting. Do you, I mean, you clearly do know this. Like, you know when you've smashed a gig. Because sometimes I think when you're on stage, it can sometimes be a bit difficult knowing how the crowd's kind of reacting to a big venue.
I would say you get to there's sort of like there's a critical point where it breaks. So anything that's a theatre,
yeah,
is fine. I think the Hammersmith Apollo, I've never played the Apollo, but that's 3,500, and that feels big.
Yeah.
When I've been to watch comedians there, I think 3,500 isn't great. The perfect venues are the Victorian theatres where there's 600 or 700 people and they're right on top of you.
Yeah.
That beautiful, perfect, where they can see you perfectly. I've never played an arena, obviously. I've played the Alban Arena, 900 people in St. Albans. I don't think it counts. But arenas, I think, aren't like, you know, they're a quarter. I went to see Alan Partridge at the O2 and I love Alan Partridge, and it was so disappointing because he was a quarter of a mile away.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's very different. I think there needs to be like a sense of audience and community.
Yeah.
So I love those old theatres, or there's loads of like kind of old perfect music halls and really nice art centres. They're the best places for comedy.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I went and watched Parenting Hell at the O2, and I was a massive fan of that show. And
did they do stand-up as well?
No, not really. They just they basically did a podcast show, and
at an arena.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Like, it was, because it didn't quite translate. But for me as well, it's been this weird thing of like, that was like the final chapter of the book almost. Like, and I'd sort of finished it, and now, like, we haven't listened to it half as much.
Really?
Since. And it was a bit like the kind of Never Meet Your Hit. Like, it was funny. It was a funny show. Like, I don't want to say.
But did you feel detached from it because of the room?
Partly because there were so many people there.
Yeah.
And it just sort of became, I knew it obviously wasn't just us listening or whatever, but it was like, oh my.
It's not our thing.
Yeah. Like, it sort of had this weird break that, yeah.
So I do think there's a comedy club called the Comedy Cellar in Bracknell, which doesn't sound glamorous. It's the oldest comedy club out of London in the UK. It's run every Friday for 37 years. And it is a room with 110 people in, but really there should be 90. And everyone's rammed in. It's tiny and it's sweaty and it's just the perfect place for comedy. Low ceiling. Those big cavernous rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a connection, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I think, yeah, those, like, that's where I'd love to play. Like, the little 500-seat vaudeville theatres, that would be the dream.
That's what the dream. It's really interesting. And so tell us why you started the podcast, I Am Primate. Well, so you've done two podcasts before.
I'm a podcast. So I had my first podcast was...
God knows how many hours driving a week. I'm not surprised you're a podcast.
God, I love a podcast. Oh, I love a podcast and I love an audio book. So I did one years ago called Citation Needed. This is before podcasts were like, much of a thing, which is all about unanswered questions with no answer. And then Matt Willis from Busted and I did a podcast together in lockdown called When No One's Watching. And it was all about the things you do when you're alone, like your guilty pleasures, the things you enjoy that, you know, like ketchup sandwiches or Eurovision, like that sort of stuff. Yeah. And then this one, I have a really interesting thing where I have never spoken about politics on stage. I've never done anything political on telly or anything like that, but I'm a politics nerd.
Yeah.
I love politics. And I also wanted to work in it for years. Like, I did politics A-level and my dream was to be, you know, your old job.
Yeah, yeah.
To go and do that. So I always wanted to do something with it. And then my girlfriend and I used to play, what would you do? I'll tell you what I'd do if I was in charge. I'd ban supermarket trolleys, whatever, some ridiculous thing, you know, and you'd always like, it's a pub conversation essentially, isn't it? Which I think is always quite a good podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, oh, you should write it up as an idea. And so that's why it's sort of what I've always wanted, to be a little bit more political, but it's very much an entertainment show.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, and it's
although your episode was both, like, yours really straddled it beautifully.
Yeah.
Because like, it was so much entertainment, but like so much fascinating insight into a world that, look, I love magicians, right? And yeah, I love finding out how they do it. Loads of people don't want to know. I love knowing how the sausage is made. And it's the same with what you used to do, you know, being able to ask you about how it happens.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you're seeing this a lot though, like in sort of entertainment at the moment, right? You're seeing it with all the football shows that are coming out, right? Like in terms of seeing the behind the scenes stuff of how this stuff
I love through. Inside the Factory, you know, the Greg Wallace show. All that stuff. Anything about making films, all that. Also, I did think, where are the white men with podcasts?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. By the way, tomorrow we're going to Huel to basically make a kind of like Inside the Factory type show.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Like, because this is the next evolution of our podcast, right?
Oh, my God, amazing.
Like documentary sort of stuff.
Where are they based?
Tring in Hertfordshire.
Oh, cool.
So
you're going to see how they make all the powders and potions and amazing
hopefully
stuff.
Hopefully try some new stuff and whatever. So like, and it's cool, but it's interesting how they're becoming like partly a content company as well, like in terms
everyone
of
everyone
like,
is to know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I do work for Red Bull, and Red Bull are the innovators of being a content company. So I do the Red Bull soapbox race on Dave. I do every so often. I used to do all of them, but I would do a few of them now. And like that, Red Bull are the genius at going, well, we're going to have a TV station and a magazine, and we're going to produce all our own stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the Red Bull story is bonkers from like a product innovation point, because who was thinking at the start of the 2000s, like, what I really need is like a really expensive fizzy can of stuff that doesn't taste amazing.
I think officially it does taste amazing.
Yeah, okay,
actually,
you're
right?
Okay to say that. But a caffeinated kind of like it's become this massive thing. I mean, hats off to
them. It's like it's all brand, isn't it?
Yeah,
like I love Rory Sutherland, who talks about all that kind of stuff. Do you know him, the ad guy?
Yeah.
Oh my God, all that is so fascinating. But everything is about that now. Like, you can't just be someone making a podcast. Your podcast has to be a brand. Even as a comedian, you know, they go, okay, so you do stand up, what else do you do?
Yeah,
you know, you do TikTok, you do this, you do that. It's all about like having this 360 degree, you become an industry, you know. Like, I'm a limited company, and I always look at it like my company, what we're doing as a company, rather than what I'm doing. I'm just the only employee. That's the best, like the healthiest way to look at it.
Really interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, that's how it's become. It used to be you'd just be like some traveling, you know, a travelling bard, basically, up and down the country. And it was all cash back in the day, like before me.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, they're all making like a... when the clubs were good, the money hasn't really changed in the clubs for like 15, 20 years. They're all making like $2,000 a week cash.
Yeah.
Oh, the dream.
Yeah, yeah.
As you know, it's all backs now, so...
Yeah.
Got to claim it.
That and your payments on, what's the app thing, the Etsy payments and Vinted and all that.
Oh my God, yeah. And I've got to pay for a website. It's so expensive. Every time you turn around, you're like, oh yeah, I forget I'm paying for that thing as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Ugh, nightmare.
What's the worst thing about being a comic?
The uncertainty.
Yes.
Like very often you'll go into a year, like you start every year and you don't know what's going on. Like at least the level I'm at, you know, I don't have like a massive tour booked, so... I'll go, I don't have anything big or interesting this year. I've just got like club gigs, but not much else. The uncertainty is hard.
Yeah. How do you deal with that?
Badly. Every year I get to January and I panic book loads of stuff I shouldn't be doing. Loads of stuff that's like lower level stuff. And I go, oh God, I've just put it all in.
Yeah.
And then it comes around and I go, God, I wish I wasn't doing that shit gig for £100.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, yeah. That must be quite, yeah.
But then it's also the best thing. I love that every year, like, you know, last January... I started the year and I didn't know I'd end up doing a radio show 5 days a week for 8 months. And like every single year you do something, or like this year I've been to, you know, I did the Istanbul Comedy Festival last year. I went to Jordan for some work. Like, I also like that at the beginning of every year, like it's a blank slate and you end up having the year you don't see.
So what were you doing in Jordan then?
Red Bull stuff.
Right,
but
okay.
Like every year, you know, like some years you'll, you know, I travel the world and stuff, but every year, like some, I do something that I wasn't expecting all the time. And that's really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And what do you hope to achieve in the next couple of years?
I would love to. I've started playing the lottery, and I'm hoping that pays off.
But you get disappointed when you
the thing it. Is, I spoke to another comedian about this, and I was like, oh, I bought a lottery ticket this week, and they went, oh, so you've given up on the career then? And that's what they thought. They're like, oh, buying lottery tickets is you going, I'm never going to make it.
What do you think the future of comedy looks like? What's your kind of one prediction for the next 5-10 years?
I think it's all about live with comedy. Like, no matter what level you're at, if you're selling out the O2 or you're playing the clubs, like, live comedy is very healthy at the moment. And lots of comedians who were doing the clubs, who found their own audience, all they want to do is spin that off into touring, really. So, like, I think there are a lot of people going to comedy that weren't going before because they discovered it on things like TikTok and through podcasts.
Okay, yeah.
And, like, live podcasting. Who thought that would have been a thing 10 years ago?
Yeah, totally.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I think all of these industries, it's all about getting people in a room, because as we get further into our phones, actually, people love that experience even more.
That's really interesting. If there's one piece of content of yours that people should go and check out after this, what is it?
Oh, gosh. I made a documentary about millionaire dogs in 2015 that's pretty great. Oh. No, I'm joking. It was absolute dog shit. And no one watches ITVB. I don't think you could even get the documentary on ITVX. I think my podcast, I'm really proud of it at the moment. I really enjoy it, and there's loads of interesting people on it.
Yeah, because you're like 15 episodes in. Which one have you enjoyed most doing?
Really loved, and not just because you're in front of me, I loved yours because it was... What I like about each one is they're so different because the people are different.
Yeah.
So you were amazing and really different. And Alex Jones from The One Show.
She was good.
She was great because she was really funny, and it was something you don't see of her every time. Whereas sometimes the comedians can be quite serious on it, which I like, but I do like the funny
stuff.
People
almost use it as an opportunity to flip the other...
Yeah, absolutely. You get the opposite of what people give. But Alex Jones and you are the two I'd go to. To get the two extremes of what the podcast can be.
Which comedian initially inspired you?
To begin with, Russell Howard I loved, and Greg Davies. They were my two.
Yeah.
Love them.
Who's the most underrated comic at the moment?
At the moment, there's Zoe Lyons, I think, should be playing arenas. She's absolutely amazing. And Andrew Bird, who's a guy on the circuit who's just one of the best and works with everyone like Michael McIntyre, Russell Howard, supporting them because they all know he's amazing.
Tip for somebody thinking of getting into comedy who's age 22, 23.
Wait until you're older than me, because I don't need the competition.
Who's a sort of favourite celebrity that you've met that was more down to earth than you expected?
Oh my God. Michael Bublé.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's only two I've ever met. You know when people talk about the X Factor?
Yeah.
So, like, that have that extra something. Michael Bublé, Harry Styles, like, special people. Changed the atmosphere of a room as they walked in.
Wow.
Like, genuinely, like, blew me away.
How? Why?
Just everything about... They were superstars. I can't explain it in any other terms. Like, they came in, there was something special.
They had that
indescribable extra thing.
That's really interesting. What TV shows have you done? What was your favourite TV show?
My favourite TV show I've ever done. That's a really good question. I made a game show for E4 called The Hangover Games, where we would send people on a night out and they thought they were making a documentary called Britain's Best Night Out. And then I'd wake them up at 6 a.m. the next day and invite them to come play a game show based around their evening.
Sounds like most stag do, to be honest.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Drunk activity.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd make them like drink things or like guess what happened the night before. It was absolute carnage. I loved making that show and no one saw it, and it was such a shame.
What job would you most like to do?
What job? Any job in
any
entertainment?
Job. Yeah.
Oh my God. I would love to wake up tomorrow as Alan Carr. I think he gets to do all the good things.
Okay.
Travel shows, game shows, great tours. Anything he's done, I think is fantastic.
And what about any job outside of entertainment?
Any job outside of entertainment?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's a really good question. Because entertainment is for people who can't do anything else. I would love... God, that's a really good question. I think I'd love politics. Like, I'd love to go and do something in politics. I'm not sure what. Probably for a think tank, so there's some money involved.
Okay.
Get me into Tufton Street.
Get me into Tufton Street. Don't start. what would you do if you were Prime Minister for a day?
If I was Prime Minister for a day...
This is, like, really meta now, because this
If I was Prime Minister for a day, I would make everyone... have a day off.
Yeah.
I'd make everyone just have... There's one day where we all just... Not just like everyone has a day off.
Everyone.
Just to have a nice day. And I think that would change everyone's attitude. Just a little reset.
Yeah.
I think that would be important.
That's really great. Matt Richardson, thanks for coming on Jimmy's Jobs of the Future.
Thank you.
Check out your podcast at I Am Prime Minister.